Have you ever achieved this really massive goal, like maybe a huge promotion you've been fighting for literally years, or you finally wrapped up this grueling high-stakes
Oh,
project?
yeah. The kind where you've basically given up your weekends for months.
Exactly. And instead of feeling on top of the world when it's done, you just felt about empty.
Yeah, just this complete void.
Right. Like you endured the freezing cold, you finally planted your flag at the summit, and your only thought was, is this it? Is this all there is?
It is the absolute definition of a hollow victory. I mean, the grand finale arrives, the struggle is supposed to suddenly make sense, and instead you're just hit with this profound sense of disorientation.
It's so jarring. Well, today we're going deep into what our sources call the meaning vacuum in high-performance cultures.
It is a fascinating topic.
It really is. We are looking at a pretty dense, multidisciplinary stack of research today. We're covering neurobiology, behavioral psychology, dramaturgical sociology, and even some existential philosophy.
Which sounds heavy, but it all connects perfectly.
It does. Our mission for this deep dive is to decode exactly why our modern structures of achievement are, unraveling the very meaning they were designed to create in the first place.
And more importantly, looking at how we can actually fix our human operating system.
Yes, exactly. Okay, let's unpack this, and I think we should start with the literal biology of ambition.
Right, because to understand the psychological emptiness of the modern workplace, we really have to look at the biological hardware that's driving the worker.
The actual brain chemistry.
Exactly. As most neuroscience literature now confirms, dopamine is an anticipatory neuromodulator.
Anticipatory, meaning it's about the buildup.
Yes, it is the chemical of wanting, not the chemical of liking. I mean, people widely misunderstand dopamine as this pleasure molecule, but it functions primarily as a prediction signal.
So it's mobilizing your physical and cognitive resources toward a perceived future reward.
That's it. It's the craving, not the satisfaction. Your dopamine levels spike during the pursuit phase of a project, and that keeps you in a state of high arousal.
It narrows your focus,
Yeah,
right?
right. But the biological trap lies in what happens the moment you actually secure that reward.
The crash.
Yeah, the dopamine response drops. If the reward matches your prediction, it drops back to baseline. But in our modern hyper-competitive corporate environments, the system has been severely overstimulated.
Because of all the digital tools and constant connectivity.
Precisely. Think about how tools like Slack or Zoom sort of weaponize this anticipation. You are constantly pinged with micro-pursuits all day long.
Oh man, yeah, the constant notifications.
Right. And because of that chronic overstimulation, the drop often falls severely below baseline. It creates an actual physiological deficit. The nervous system basically used all its chemical reserves solely for the hunt.
So it's kind of like your dopaminergic system is a biological GPS.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Yeah, you plug in the destination and it lights up. It guides you, it tells you exactly when to turn, and it keeps you totally focused on the ETA.
It is obsessed with the EPA.
Right, but it only cares about the ETA. The exact second you park the car in the driveway, the GPS just shuts off.
It's done its job.
Exactly. The screen goes black and it just leaves you sitting there alone in the dark.
That is exactly what happens. The biological job is done, so your body is telling you the pursuit is over. And behavioral scientist Tal Ben-Shahar actually coined a term for how we interpret this.
What's the term?
He calls it the arrival fallacy. It's this cognitive illusion that reaching a destination, whether that's an IPO or a corporate acquisition or, winning an Olympic gold, will bring lasting happiness.
When the reality is that the sudden absence of friction and deadlines just brings a depressive crash.
Exactly. You lose the anticipation and you just crash.
So if our brain's dopamine system practically guarantees that we'll feel empty after a big win, the obvious question for me is, why do we keep falling for it?
You'd think we'd learn, right?
Yeah. Why don't high achievers just learn the lesson and adjust their expectations?
Well, the tragedy is that high achievers misinterpret this biological drop. They subconsciously assume the crash is what the sources call a failure of magnitude.
A failure of magnitude, like the goal just wasn't big enough.
Yes. They tell themselves the goal simply wasn't grand enough to deliver the promised salvation.
Wow.
So to fix the emptiness, what do? They open a new spreadsheet, draft a new strategic plan, and set a target that is twice as extreme.
Just throwing themselves right back onto that hedonic hamster wheel of chronic stress.
Exactly. They divorce themselves from the present moment to chase a bigger future high.
So the neurobiology forces a crash, and then the psychology of adaptation just overrides our logic entirely. We shift our psychological baselines just to cope.
and that psychological shift is known as hedonic adaptation. Researchers Brickman and Campbell posited that human beings possess an innate tendency to rapidly return to a stable baseline of emotion.
Regardless of what happens to them, right?
Right, regardless of major positive or negative events. As you achieve higher status or accumulate wealth, your expectations and material desires rise in exact tandem.
So instead of a hamster wheel, it's almost more like building up a tolerance to a medication.
This is a very accurate way to put it.
Like, last year's record-breaking revenue is now just the baseline dosage required to keep the executive team from going into withdrawals.
Yes, the extraordinary metabolizes into the ordinary. Very quickly, too.
Which is terrifying.
It is. And in high-performance cultures, this tolerance building leads to what the research calls abundance denial.
Abundance denial.
Yeah. Highly successful people construct these elaborate, completely sincere rationales for why they are actually deprived.
Wait, seriously?
Yes. They will look at an objectively privileged position and genuinely feel suffocated by scarcity because their baseline has adjusted so drastically.
So they're running faster to outrun the void, but emotionally they remain entirely stationary.
Exactly. And at a certain point, the mind does something even more extreme to cope with this. It starts just chasing the work, and it starts merging with the work.
The sources call this identity fusion, right?
Yes, identity fusion. Mm. The boundaries between your personal self and your occupational role dissolve.
It shifts from I do this work to I am this work.
Precisely. Cognitive anthropology views this as much more severe than just strongly identifying with a profession. It is a complete structural union of the personal and social selves. The occupational avatar consumes the human being entirely.
Wait, I have to push back on this a little bit.
Sure, go ahead.
Isn't deeply caring about your job and tying your identity to your craft just what we generally call passion? I mean, yeah. We celebrate that in our culture.
We do, absolutely.
So at what point does healthy passion mutate into this toxic fusion?
Well, what's fascinating here is the critical difference lies in how the brain's threat detection system responds. Passion is when you love the work, but you can put it down.
You can walk away at the end of the day.
Right. Fusion turns standard professional hurdles into existential lethal threats. If you are fused, a missed deadline, a lost client, or a critical performance review isn't just a work problem.
What is it then?
It is processed by your amygdala as a direct moral failure. It registers as a literal threat to your survival.
Because if the work fails, you fail to exist.
Exactly. And that existential threat makes psychological detachment impossible.
Which is so dangerous for burnout.
Oh, it guarantees it. Research consistently shows that psychological detachment during non-work hours is the absolute strongest predictor of recovery from occupational stress.
But the fused individual cannot detach.
No. They're answering emails at 2 a.m., rehearsing work arguments in the shower, treating their weekend like a strategic planning retreat. By destroying their own recovery periods, they ensure severe burnout.
It's basically a crisis of identity masquerading as exhaustion.
That's a great way to summarize it.
So, okay, we've established that the individual is biologically wired to experience a post-achievement crash and psychologically vulnerable to merging their very soul with their job.
Right.
What happens when organizations take those vulnerabilities and actively exploit them using flawed corporate systems?
Well, the result is a sociological vacuum. To understand the pervasive emptiness of elite organizational cultures, our sources turn to dramaturgical sociology.
Specifically Irving Goffman, right? From his book, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life.
Yes. He posited that social interaction is essentially an elaborate theatrical performance.
Where the workplace is the front stage.
Exactly. In high-performance cultures, leaders and employees are trapped on that front stage. They're required to wear masks of hypercompetence, invulnerability, and perpetual enthusiasm.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let me just ask you, the listener, directly. Have you ever faked a smile on a video call while secretly drowning in burnout?
I think we all have.
Right, because Goffman says that is you acting on the front stage. It's like modern corporate politics is this zero-sum gladiator arena where everyone is just pretending to fight for the optics of it all.
Yes, and historically, workers had a backstage. You know, a private sanctuary, maybe the commute home or the break room, where you could drop the mask, doubt yourself, and just recover.
But the always-on digital culture has completely erased that backstage.
It has. The requirement to perform continuously is aggressively fueled by status competition. When status within a company is achieved not through genuine value creation, but through political maneuvering and optics, the workplace transforms.
Into a theater production.
Yes, where everyone has forgotten the plot but refuses to stop acting. It repels authenticity. If you admit you're exhausted, you break character and the system punishes you.
And then organizations try to govern these complex human dynamics using blunt financial instruments, which just locks the sociological pressure into place.
That's a disaster.
Yeah, the research clearly indicates that poorly designed incentive structures don't just fail, they actively destroy meaning and ethics.
The sources outline two massive systemic failures here. The first is what they call the ratchet effect.
The ratchet effect, how does that work?
Well, when workers realize that giving maximum effort today just means the company will set higher, more punitive targets tomorrow, they logically adapt.
They throttle their effort.
Exactly. They intentionally throttle it. A sales team might have the capacity to close 20 deals, but they stop at 15, because hitting 20 means next year's quota will be 25.
So the system designed to maximize output actually breeds strategic mediocrity. The workers are just rationally protecting themselves from a machine that will never be satisfied.
Right. But the second systemic failure is even darker. It's called ethical fading.
Ethical fading.
Yes. When heavy financial bonuses are tied to narrow metrics, it creates such severe goal fixation that it alters the employee's perception of reality.
The text cites those loan officers leading up to the 2008 financial crisis, right? We just want to impartially report what the sources say here, but it's a wild example.
It is. These individuals were heavily incentivized to approve sketchy mortgage applications. And the psychological research shows they didn't just knowingly do something bad while twirling their mustaches.
Right. It wasn't cartoon villainy.
No. The incentive structure actually narrowed their cognitive framing. Their literal perception of the risk changed.
So small moral breaches become so normalized that they stop registering as moral decisions at all.
That is ethical fading in a nutshell.
The underlying why of the work is erased in favor of the metric. Our philosophical sources put it perfectly. They say, innovation without soul becomes illusion.
It's a powerful quote.
It really is. When an organization reduces its entire philosophy to a quarterly numerical target, it strips the work of its existential weight, leaving the workforce completely adrift.
The workforce is just left to execute meaningless tasks while pretending to be deeply fulfilled by them.
So we are biologically trapped, psychologically fused, and sociologically incentivized to fake it until we break. The meaning vacuum is absolute.
It is a bleak picture.
Very. So how do we restructure the human operating system? Because clearly the answer isn't just sending out a company-wide memo lecturing everyone on morals.
No, absolutely not. Our sources explicitly warn against prescriptive moral leadership. The traditional corporate response to burnout and ethical fading is to pivot to moralism.
But the problem is that morality is entirely subjective.
Exactly. One person's servant leadership is another person's weakness. Different ethical frameworks clash, and that creates friction, which just breeds more resentment.
And forces everyone back onto the front stage to fake their compliance all over again.
Right. The human organism is fundamentally a meaning-making entity. From an evolutionary perspective, meaning was necessary for survival because it bound tribal structures together.
So when you starve people of that meaning, their evolutionary hardware just malfunctions.
Yes. The antidote isn't preaching morality. The antidote is architecting coherence.
Coherent leadership. This brings in the physicist Ilya Prigozhin. He had this fascinating idea regarding complex systems.
Yes, his work is very relevant here.
He said that when a system is chaotic and far from equilibrium, small islands of coherence have the capacity to shift the whole system to a higher order.
And a coherent leader becomes one of those islands. They don't preach or dictate feelings. They act as a stabilizing architecture in the chaos.
Just by being aligned.
Right. By ensuring that awareness, decisions, and actions remain perfectly aligned, they absorb the chaotic noise of the organization and radiate predictability. They allow truth to naturally emerge.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? How does a leader actually become an island of coherence on a random Tuesday?
It takes structure.
Right. How do we build this? The research gives us the coherence to meaning framework, which is built on five distinct pillars. Let's break these down because this is where the theory actually hits the pavement.
Okay.
Pillar number one is rituals.
Yes. In a digital workspace that has completely erased the physical boundaries between the office and the home, rituals are the architecture that grounds us.
Because we don't have the commute anymore.
Exactly. The text specifically notes, even the digital can hold ritual. And this isn't about, you know, casual Fridays or pizza parties.
Right.
It means establishing non-negotiable communication blackouts after hours. It's about creating end-of-day practices, like a mandated shutdown routine, that explicitly transition the individual out of their professional avatar.
And back into their personal self. You are literally manufacturing a backstage to break the identity fusion.
Exactly.
Which brings us to pillar two, narrative integrity. This means aligning the myth of the company with the matrix of reality.
You can't just talk the talk.
Right. You can't put health and wellness on a poster in the break room if you only promote people who work 80-hour weeks.
Narrative integrity demands that a coherent system rewards the how, not just the what.
Give us an example of that.
Well, imagine a manager who hits their ambitious revenue target, but their turnover rate is sky high because they burned out their entire team to do it. A traditional system praises the revenue.
But a coherent system.
A coherent system treats that manager's achievement as a structural failure because the narrative of the company's values was violated to achieve it.
Which flows perfectly into pillar three, values to decision alignment. Values can't just be abstract concepts, right?
No, they must act as immediate algorithmic filters for every single decision. The framework suggests using what they call the power of three.
The power of three.
Yes. Evaluating choices through a foundational past, an active present, and a strategic future.
Let's apply that to a practical scenario. Say a leadership team is facing a tough quarterly earnings crunch, and they're considering launching an underdeveloped product just to boost short-term numbers.
Okay, so a coherent leader applies the power of three. Past. Why did we build this company? To provide reliable solutions, not half-baked ones.
Present. What are we sacrificing today? Our engineering team's sanity and our quality control.
Exactly. And future. What debt are we creating? A massive customer service crisis next year.
The sources summarize this pillar with a great directive. They say, build tools that heal, not just solve.
I love that.
Yeah. If launching that product triggers the ratchet effect or ethical fading, the coherent leader rejects it, regardless of the short-term profit.
Because the long-term health of the system is prioritized over the immediate dopamine hit of a quarterly win.
Exactly. And that brings us to pillar four, which feels incredibly radical in today's culture. Humane pace.
It really does feel radical, unfortunately. Yeah.
The text literally says, the earth does not hurry, and yet everything blooms. Human capital doesn't scale linearly with hours worked. The data shows output absolutely plummets after about 50 hours.
It does. So coherent leadership enforces a limit on work hours, so the dopaminergic system can actually reset. They recognize that constant urgency destroys complex problem solving.
So by enforcing a humane pace, you prevent the arrival fallacy from generating perpetual dissatisfaction.
Right. The system treats rest not as a reward for burning out, but as a biological necessity. And really an act of resistance against the meaning vacuum.
Finally, we have pillar five, truth systems. Organizations must build epistemic awareness.
Epistemic awareness just means an organization deeply understands how it processes information and filters reality.
It requires hardwiring transparency into the infrastructure, right?
Yes. You have to build feedback loops where bad news travels up the chain without the messenger getting shot.
Because if an organization obscures reality through hidden agendas or performative politics, employees have to spend all their cognitive energy just deciphering what is actually true.
And the meaning vacuum expands because everyone is too busy playing defense.
But when employees know the system is genuinely transparent, when epistemic awareness is high, the heavy cognitive load of defensive posturing evaporates.
They no longer have to waste energy on the front stage performance. They can trust the environment.
That's huge.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, a coherent leader just builds a system where the truth isn't dangerous. And when the truth isn't dangerous, people can finally breathe.
They can decouple their identity from their output.
Exactly. They can re-engage with their work, not as a terrified survival mechanism, but as a conscious, meaningful choice.
It's a total paradigm shift. I mean, to try and distill this massive deep dive for you, the listener, the modern meaning vacuum isn't some personal failing on your part.
It's really not.
It isn't because you aren't grinding hard enough. It is the inevitable mathematical result of trying to extract infinite output from a finite human architecture.
We've allowed our ancient dopamine loops to be hijacked by digital immediacy.
We've fused our identities to our jobs to cope with the emptiness. And we've trapped ourselves in a theatrical performance driven by toxic incentives.
Rebuilding meaning in the workplace isn't a luxury perk or a soft HR initiative. It is a biological and evolutionary imperative.
It's the only way a complex system survives long term without collapsing under its own psychological weight.
Absolutely.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought from the existential philosophy side of our source.
Oh, this is a great point to end on.
The text proposes that existence operates as a complex fractal system. And in this system, the observer and the observed are intimately entangled. It argues that reality actually responds to coherence.
It shifts the burden from the individual right back to the systemic connection. It's a profound way to look at our place in the broader architecture of work and life.
So ponder this. What if your personal feelings of burnout, you know, that profound emptiness you felt after achieving that massive goal, what if that isn't just an individual failure?
What if it's a signal?
Right. What if you are acting as a sensory organ for a society that is fundamentally out of rhythm? If reality truly responds to coherence, as this research suggests, then perhaps your decision to simply rest, to close the laptop, and to set a firm boundary isn't just self-care.
It might be the most powerful act of systemic rebellion you can take.
Exactly. You are demanding coherence from the universe by embodying it yourself. You're turning the biological GPS back on, but this time you're setting the destination for yourself. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Take a breath, drop the mask, and we'll see you next time.